You're listening to This Week in Palestine. I'm your host, Anne Lucas. Sabah al-khair, masa al-khair, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, and I am your host, Anne Lucas. This week, I am so happy to be sharing Owen Jones interviewing Ilan Pappé. If you don't know, Owen Jones is a British journalist, newspaper columnist, commentator, author, and also a political activist. He writes a column for The Guardian and contributes to The Statesman and The Tribune and The National. He has multiple weekly web series, and that is where he interviewed Ilan Pappé this past week. Ilan Pappé is someone I've shared regularly on this show. And as someone who is also a cultural historian of the region, I'm rather biased towards his analysis. But he literally wrote the book on the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, and many books and articles since then on the settler colonial project he was born into called Israel. I know Owen has been trying to interview him for a while. That scheduling finally worked out this week. Pappé had some particular predictions in early October 2023, but he has some new historical perspective now in 2025. It is truly a moment for any historian of Palestine to reassess. But Pappé's original analysis from October 2023 hasn't changed, but expanded, and there are more insights to be had at this particular moment. And what I love about this interview is that it is eyes wide open. There are no rose-colored glasses for Palestinians here. That said, there are structural reasons to not be despondent and to keep pushing in the direction of Palestinian liberation. There are reasons to believe that Palestinian liberation is closer than ever to being a reality. It may not feel like anything is moving in the right direction, but history shows it's not the time to give up. It's the time to keep pushing more than ever. I found this interview insightful and realistic, but also inspiring, and I think you will too. I know you know what's coming, because we really do have a lot to listen to. So yalla bina, let's go.
Now, Ilan Pappé, the celebrated Israeli historian, has been long one of the most important voices that we have when it comes to talking about Israel and Palestine. And since the current genocide began, of course, his voice has become even more important than ever. Ilan, it's such an honour to be able to speak to you. Belatedly, I should have done this a long time ago. So I'm glad we're finally communicating on video. And I know my audience will be delighted. Great to speak to you. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you. And thank you so much for having me. Yes, we already planned that long time ago. I'm glad it unfolded eventually.
It's finally happened. So look, let's just actually begin. You know, we're coming to the end now of 2024. And already, I remember thinking back to the end of 2023 and thinking about the horror being unleashed against the people of Gaza. And I have to say, if I knew, maybe I wouldn't be shocked, but knew a year later that we'd be discussing still the apparently limitless amount of depravity being unleashed against the people of Gaza, I think I'd been pretty chilled by that, to be honest. And here we are. What have you? I want to ask you, as a, you know, this, you're a historian of Israel and Palestine, and you know, the historical context is always on your mind. What have you learned since October 2023? Has anything changed in the way you look at this?
Yes, I think in two ways. Something, I think, two aspects became a bit clearer compared to all of ours. More immediate reactions. And, you know, immediate reactions are sometimes a bit amiss because it makes sense. You don't have a perspective and you don't really know how things develop. But I think now we have a better sense. So one thing that is clear to me, although I already felt this was true even a few months after the 7th of October, that contrary to what some people say, we are not at the beginning of the worst chapter in the history of Palestine and the Palestinians in general, and that of Gaza, of course, in particular. Mm-hmm. I think we are in the end of that chapter. So I think that this kind of chapter in history that began in the Nakba in 1948, some people rightly would say maybe even earlier, but definitely with the ethnic cleansing of 1948 and the Palestinian call, this whole historical chapter, the ongoing Nakba, in Arabic, al-Nakba al-Mustamira, this has now reached an apex, undoubtedly, of brutality, of ruthlessness. Ethnic cleansing has turned into genocide. All this is true, but I don't think it's an indication that now a long chapter of destruction is continuing. I really think that this is going to be the beginning of the end of the Zionist colonialist project in Palestine, exactly because it is so ruthless. And because, and we may elaborate about it a bit later, but that's one kind of analysis that I hesitated to present at the very beginning of the events, and now I'm much more confident about it. The second one, and this is still for me the greatest surprise, if you want, or bewilderment of what happened. I mean, I was not surprised by the level of violence the Hamas performed on the 7th of October, and I'm afraid to say that I was not surprised by the level of the brutality and inhumanity of the Israeli reaction. I was surprised by the total indifference of the West, and in particular of the European West. This is still something that I can provide some partial explanation for why this indifference to the most televised daily genocide we've ever had since the beginning of the end of the Second World War, but I'm still find it beyond comprehension. And that is a process that has, to my mind, impact beyond the question of Gaza or Palestine. I think that impacts the whole issue of the international legal system, the whole issue of what are universal values and the face of the global South in anything that the global North or global West would put forward as universal principles for running the world or the order in the world. So I think that's a huge crisis of confidence in international institutions and laws that will have far-reaching impact on all of us, wherever we are, in years to come.
I mean, before I ask you about the first part, which is very, very challenging, I think a lot of people listening to that, particularly in the here and now, would definitely obviously want me to ask you to expand on that, so I will. But before I do, I mean, that second point you talk about, the indifference, because I think, I mean, one thing I've always said is never stop being shocked, even if you understand the dynamics at play. You can understand the dynamics at play, but you should never be numb. But it is about that, which is, I wrote a piece last month where I just, the reason I was really struck by what you said is I tried to put that in words. And I wrote about an apparently invisible fortress, the West's official narrative of Israel's onslaught against Gaza. And what I was trying to look at is, it didn't matter how depraved the atrocity or how overwhelming the evidence or how confessed to the crime, because, you know, as Raz Segal, the Israeli-American associate professor of Holocaust and Genocide Study, puts it, it's very rare for intent actually to be so explicit in these cases. And we've seen that from the very start. But it doesn't matter. The narrative always, the official respectable narrative always survives. When you and I talk about, say, genocide or even war crimes, that almost puts a badgerness as outside of the official respectable narrative. We're extreme, we're radicals, we're dangerous. Do you see what I mean? I'm interested in that. It's almost though there's no level of depravity or confession to depravity. That narrative has remained titanium protected. Nothing seems to budge it in respectable circles.
Well, definitely. First of all, it's a fair analysis. I think very few people can argue with you that this is the situation. Now, let's see if we can at least unpack it a bit and see if we can explain it. Maybe it's the historian in me, but I do think there is an historical context for that kind of immunity, that kind of exceptionalism, this kind of gap between the reality, the stark reality on the ground, and the false language and vocabulary used to describe it by people who definitely are not idiots. And one cannot suspect that they are not educated or knowledgeable. And yet they do it maybe even knowingly or maybe unconsciously. I don't know. But I do think it's especially in Europe. Let's put the Americans aside for a moment. That was a good idea. The Europeans, I think, still treat this whole issue of Israel and Palestine as something that they are part of. And their part in it is not a pleasant one. It's almost like a complicity. Because Zionism, in the end of the day, was as a European solution for a European problem. Mm. The problem was the way Europe treated its Jews through racism and eventually through genocide. And Zionism, whoever conceived it, provided this easy way out by saying we'll build a European Jewish state at the heart of the Arab world, at the heart of the Muslim world, we'll impose it on the indigenous people of Palestine, and by that we can forget about it. But it seems that it doesn't work, and therefore, in order not to fully appreciate and accept the consequences of this impracticable, immoral project that was sustained through force, not through moral validity, only through force. I think this is where there's still a hope that maybe with language they can kind of launderette the fact that the solution for this European problem was the destruction of Palestine and the Palestinians, not only saving the Jews, but actually destroying another people. And all these European, jugglery, saying it's a small injustice to rectify a bigger one. After the last year, you cannot even say that sentence in any serious manner. And I think that is really the issue here. As long as the Israeli oppression was incremental, here and there justified, or could be covered up as part of self-defense and part of an attempt to sustain a so-called peace process, fine, it worked. But what Israel did in Gaza did not allow any such maneuvering or manipulations. And I think it's a partial explanation. I don't think it's the only one, and our Marxist friends rightly would add some economic interest into that. But I think that's a very important psychological infrastructure for that kind of incomprehensible indifference to the suffering of people, which is daily screened on our phones and televisions and so on. Yeah.
I mean, with that, I mean, it's the live streaming, as you said. I mean, obviously, the work of Palestinian journalists who suffered the biggest loss of journalists in recorded history, often alongside their family, their children. That point about intent, about confession, which I've tried to raise over and over again, but it's almost like it's compartmentalized in a parallel universe, in that you'll get Israeli leaders and officials who say one thing to their local audiences, and then they have their spokespeople who come on Western media outlets to claim they're abiding by international law and not attacking civilians, which they don't say actually to the, if you listen to what they say at home in Hebrew. That's what's happened. It's almost, Western media coverage didn't frame itself around that intent. I often give this hideous example, to be honest, right at the beginning. And this was the Israeli general in charge of Kogat, which is, for those who don't know, the civilian affairs. And he said, Hamas became ISIS and the citizens of Gaza are celebrating instead of being horrified. Human animals are dealt with accordingly. Israel has imposed a total blockade on Gaza. No electricity, no water, just damage. You wanted hell, you will get hell. That was in a tweet addressed to both Hamas and the residents of Gaza. So there's no pretense there, but that was almost not covered in any single Western media outlet. Do you see what I mean? It's a different universe. That's how it has to, you just have to just pretend it's not being said or done.
Absolutely. Sometimes I think the Israelis treat Hebrew as a secret language, and therefore they allow themselves to say things that they think that afterwards nobody would hear, and it's just for domestic consumption. And then they're really surprised when it turns out that some people who speak Hebrew are horrified by what they said and translated to other languages. And if you look at the dossier that South Africa presented to the ICJ, it's definitely, I don't think all the people who were in this delegation knows Hebrew, but they have enough people who help them to translate into English these clear manifestation of intent by senior politicians, senior military officers. And if you go even deeper into this, to the orders that were issued by brigade commanders on the eve of the entry to Gaza, you will find this language of an intentional genocide all over it, including references to biblical chapters of, you know, genociding the Amalekites and so on. I mean, this is, unfortunately, it's a very easy case, I would say, for anyone who takes the most known definition of genocide in the United Nations Charter and checks whether this definition fits the case study of the Israeli intent, rightly as you say, not only the manifestations or the application of that policy on the ground. I would go even further, and this is something that really we have to take into account, because I do believe, as I said in my first point, that the Israelis are facing really a moment of truth in the whole history of the state. I'll come back to it in a minute. I just want to say that because of that, the only solution that the current Israeli politicians who run the country see, I'm not saying they're not aware of it, but they believe they have a window of opportunity to prevent it. And the only way to prevent it is a total destruction of the Palestinians, not just as people, but as an idea, as a concept. This is why they're attacking UNRWA. And this is why they're working now in Syria and other places to kind of create a region, an Arab world, that has put the Palestine issue behind it. And I don't think they will succeed, by the way, but I do believe that they can, you know, wreak a lot of havoc and carnage before the failure would become clear.
I mean, that's what I want to ask you about, of course, that very challenging argument that actually this could be the beginning of the end for that Zionist project. And a lot of people will go, I mean, you know, the Israeli state might just respond in a very triumphalist way. Gaza wiped off the face of the earth. The West Bank, I mean, they've got away with the pogrom there, essentially. Palestinian existence there becoming ever more unbearable. Southern Lebanon reduced large parts of it to rubble. Hezbollah smashed. Iran hobbled. The obviously now Assad regime, even though in practice it's claimed to be on, you know, actively support the Palestinian people, we're not. I mean, we can talk about it elsewhere, but you know, I think they're risible. But nonetheless, you can look at that and go, well, actually, things have gone. Yeah, sure. If you don't like mass murder, if you don't like war crimes, boo hoo hoo for you, they might say. But things are going pretty well for us. We're smashing our own enemies. We're smashing our opponents. And now we've got Donald Trump in the White House and a load of pro-Israel zealots. Things are looking pretty good for that project. That's what they would say. What do you think?
Yeah, of course. And there are two immediate points one can respond to. One is there's a huge number of Israelis who don't fancy living in a country that this is its future. This is its vision. To be constantly using military force in order to exist, and military force that has to be more and more brutal and ruthless, not only towards armies, but also towards the population. We don't know the exact number of Israelis who left after 7th of October. Some journalists in Israel put it around 700,000. Others talk about 500,000. It's not only the numbers. It is the kind of characteristic of that group that has left. And it shows you that what they understand, and this is not out of any particular solidarity with the Palestinian suffering. What they understand is that in order to survive in the state, for them, their children and their grandchildren, Israel would always have to have this upper hand in military and security means. Now, for a normal person, they would like some, you know, stability in life, some peace in one's own normal life. This is not the place to be in, undoubtedly. Even if, yes, the last 4 weeks were successful from a military point of view, Will the next 4 weeks be successful? Would it happen again? And it will happen again, of course, that there will be another Palestinian uprising. There will be another 7th of October. That's very clear. And things can change in the Arab world. But that means your only future is all the time in making sure that your military budget is the most important element in your state's budget, you know, even economically, not to mention psychologically and mentally. So that's one point, the point that this is not a vision that is shared by a large number of Israelis. I mean, some of them would say there's no other choice, unfortunately, because they can't see any options. But those who can afford it economically and because they have dual nationalities and so on and reignite their professions elsewhere are already leaving. So there's something very hollow here. There's kind of a social implosion from the inside. There's a domestic price to be paid for this supposedly invincible, the resurgence of the idea of the invincibility of the Israeli army, which I'm still doubting. I mean, they defeated two guerrilla movements. In the end of the day, that's what they did. Guerrilla movements who had no air force, had no tanks, and so on. So to put it in perspective, it's quite important as well. But the second point is also very, very, very important. This kind of vision from an economic point of view would need a very strong global alliance led by the United States. They would not only support Israel diplomatically and politically, but materially. We already know the expenditure that this success has produced beyond anything Israel has ever spent on military issues. And you think about even someone like Donald Trump and any other isolationist politician that would come from the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. I wonder whether in 5, 6, 7 years they would regard Israel as such an asset when they will have to pay for all of this, because the Israelis don't have that many resources to pay for themselves. So there are these kinds of immediate responses, but there's something more profound going on here. Unless you believe that the world cannot change, then yes, maybe it's too early to say it's the beginning of the end. But if you have even, you know, a modicum of belief that the political system we live in, whether it's in Britain or in Israel or in the United States or in Turkey, it doesn't matter. If you even have a modicum of belief that the current political situation or constellation is not forever, you don't take a determinist view, and you think about more positive alternatives to the existing political system, any positive alternative, even a slight move towards such an alternative model, will bring the end of the Zionist project closer. Because the way you can sustain Israel is only in a world that is ruled by populist leaders, right-wing neo-fascist parties, dictators in the Arab world, a democratic Arab world, a more democratic and liberal even, West and global South, would not tolerate the kind of state that Israel has become.
I mean, I totally take your point about, you know, the illusion of every age is that it will last forever. And I agree with you. But I guess, you know, in the here and now, one might look at the position Israel's in. I mean, you say, you know, for example, the idea, you know, another October 7th could happen. But I mean, you know, some might go, well, there was only one 7th of October that ever happened in the history of Israel. And that was because the Israeli military, you know, they saw Gaza as a sealed tomb from which nobody would ever emerge anyway. And they didn't have their military in place to prevent what happened, including, of course, the killing of Israeli civilians. But that they wouldn't make that mistake ever again. I mean, what do you think? You know, they can just insulate Israel from anything. And, you know, if there's any attack on them, they just wipe out southern Lebanon.
You know, they were surprised when the first Intifada broke out. They were surprised when the second one broke out. Israel needs to employ I don't know if any other country, maybe some like North Korea is a good example for that. Israel needs to employ, I think even North Korea is not as bad in that respect. Israel needs to employ hundreds of thousands of its own people to police the Palestinians so that the Palestinians would reconcile with living in mega prisons such as West Bank or in a ghetto like Gaza or in apartheid state, which is experienced by the Palestinian citizens of Israel. How long can they really do this? How much is it really a secure policy for the future if you have millions of people now reaching a number that is equal to your own citizens who are not willing to go away, are resisting, are resilient, and are not going to give up? Not to mention the millions of the same people and nation who are on Israel borders. And the fact that so many people in the civil society, in the Arab world and the Muslim world support them. I mean, you have to take into account this constellation. Yes, admittedly, to simplify, we can say there's a global Israel and global Palestine. So yes, right now, global Israel, which is made of Israel supporters, mostly populist leaders, right-wing governments, maybe even industrial military complexes and multinational corporation. Fine. Very, very powerful alliance. I don't doubt it. But there's a global Palestine, the one that is supported by so many people in civil society, which the global South, look at the position of some of the Latin American countries. Mm-hmm. Look at the changes in some countries like Estonia and mm-hmm. so on. This is an incremental process of isolating Israel, of turning it into a rogue state. I know people are very unhappy in Palestine about the ICJ and the ICC. And I can see why, because it was their rulings have not translated yet into an effective action. But I think it's a very fundamental change in the way the world relates to Israel and Palestine. The ICC and ICJ are not just an organic part of the civil society. They're kind of the medium between the civil society and the corridors of power. And I think that is very significant in the long run. So, you know, we can add to this the attitude of the young Jewish generation, including in the United States. So many Jews do not want to be associated with Israel. Now, we can all say that doesn't matter. They don't have brigades. They don't have political power. They don't have the clout in the Congress and so on. But this is a still picture, what we're talking about. We're not talking the video here. The video shows the changes. Very slow, too slow for the people of Gaza. And I'm afraid maybe even too slow for the people of the West Bank, if we are right in our apprehension that Israel would move with the same model to the West Bank. I fully agree. But in the long run, I see this as this ruthless Israel as burying its own home in terms of international standing, legitimacy, and you can buy the Arab regimes, but you cannot buy the Arab people. And Israel is still a minority in the Arab world. I mean, Israel is not part of Europe. It wants to be maybe part of Europe, but it is in the heart of the Arab world and the Muslim world that since the 2011 is undergoing its own revolution. There is now counter-revolution, but this is not over. And this whole project does not fit the aspiration of people in this part of the world and other parts of the world for a different world. And if you are in that situation, only force and more force would sustain you. And but, I wonder from my historical experience whether this is a long-term business.
Well, I suppose, yeah, with that cap on, the historical context cap on, in terms of looking as, you know, a guide, using that as the guide for the future, because that point you made about, I mean, essentially Israel's position is the Palestinian population represent an existential problem and they work backwards from that, which is why you talk about an idea. I mean, that's why you often have cheerleaders for the Israeli state say there's no such thing as the Palestinians. I mean, that's been a perennial claim, because their fear is the very identity, the sense of identity that Palestinians have poses an existential threat to the Israeli project. And as you note, the attack on UNRWA, the refugee agency for Palestinians, is they hate that because it's this idea, it sustains the idea that Palestinians are refugees who've been kicked from homes. But couldn't they just thought, you know, when Smotrich, the Israeli finance minister, talks about thinning out Gaza's population by half in 2 years, under Trump, my point is, could they just not do that? They could just gradually back people through death, through what they call voluntary migration. You make Gaza uninhabitable, obviously, which they have. And then you just, under humanitarian garbs, you just start exporting the population. Maybe do a deal with Sisi in Egypt of some description. He's a Western-backed dictator. In the West Bank, just gradually, again, asphyxiate Palestinian existence so people just leave. Do you see what I mean? I mean, couldn't they just get away with just getting rid of the Palestinian population from Gaza and the West Bank over a period of time?
They could get away in the short run, but they cannot get away in the long run. I don't want to mention names, but there were other regimes in history that 2 or 3 years after they came into power, the world seemed to be unable to stop them from any plans, whether it was occupying other nations, whether it was genociding them, and so on. And it seemed like nobody would ever be able to stop them. 5, 6 years later, they were stopped eventually. So, yes, I mean, they could do all these things, and unfortunately, they want to do all these things. And of course, I'm not just an historian, I'm also an activist. Mm-hmm. So I'm not just an onlooker and an analyst. I'm also part of a movement that would do all they can to stop it. But beyond that, let's say that we unfortunately are not that powerful right now to stop it, which is an unfortunate possibility. Nonetheless, the success of that is, to me, from an historical perspective, mm-hmm. another factor that would bring it down. I think that you have to look at the more liberal forces that were part of this global Israel alliance. What they benefited from was the kind of double talk that you referred to before, that the Israelis were kind of conveying, you know, we are actually the only democracy in the Middle East. We are part of the social democratic world, in fact, even more than just the democratic world. Yes, we have enemies, we have problems, but all in all, this is our aspiration is for peace and so on. This discourse has disappeared from the Israeli political scene. So I think it would be more and more difficult for the politicians in the West that are not populist, that are not mm-hmm. part of the fascist neo-right, to continue and do it. They still do it. There's a strong lobby. Mm-hmm. There is still fear and timidity because politicians, especially of this generation, are thinking of the next election and not of any moral values. But here and there, we can see the signs that the lobby was successfully destroying, but it will be, these signs will increase, like someone like Corbyn, someone like Bernie Sanders. I mean, these are not going to be exceptions of the rule that are going to disappear. We won't hear about them again. These are just, you know, trailblazers. This is going to change. I wish I had the formula how to narrow the gap between the very slow process that I think is positive as far as the Palestinians is concerned, regionally and globally, and the very quick process of destruction on the ground, and how to narrow the gap is our biggest mission this in this lifetime, for sure. Because you're absolutely right in the way you analyze the Israeli intentions and possibilities under Trump. In fact, by the way, not only under Trump, but don't just give it to
Trump.
Of
course. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
There are other political forces in the globe that help it. But the Palestinians are not alone. That is important. These global forces are not only representing, carte blanche for Israel to do what it wants. They also represent injustices in many other fields, including in their own countries. So there is a potential for a much stronger alliance that Palestine just epitomizes it. Mm. But it's not alone.
Because you alluded to that, you know, the Israeli propaganda kind of presentation of the only democracy in the Middle East. And, you know, I interviewed Ofer Kassif, who is a very courageous Jewish Israeli politician. And Hadash, of course, I know you've been involved in, you've stood for election under the Hadash Banner, they're the leftist alliance of Jewish and Arab citizens, Palestinian citizens of Israel. But I mean, I want to put one this by, I mean, in terms of where Israel is heading and see what you think about this, because he was talking about fascism. He just talked about, you know, fascism. He fears for his life. He says, you know, he talks about the possibility of having to flee Israel. That's what he talked about with me. Mm-hmm. But I wonder in terms of this kind of, if this is almost what you're alluding to, and see if this analogy works at all. Because in climate science, there's this idea of a hothouse effect where temperature rises, get to a point where it becomes exponential. There's a theory that's what happened to Venus. Venus is this hothouse where it's, you know, impossibly hot. The atmosphere is so thick. Now, I'm wondering if that's the process, the analogous process with the Israeli state, that you get this process of radicalization where, you know, it gets more and more, this the internal dynamic with nothing to stop it radicalizes and radicalizes and radicalizes it until it consumes the whole project and that it collapses and becomes completely and utterly unsustainable. I mean, is that what it is? Is there a hothouse effect of fascist radicalization happening in Israel at the moment?
Yes, and I think it is. And you know, like Ofer, I also fear for my life, but I'm 70 years old, so I'm going to stay where I want to stay. I would say that this is exactly what characterizes such a fascist regime in the making, or maybe is already there, as Ofer claims, that everybody becomes an enemy, not just the Palestinians. The secular Jews become the enemy. The Reform Jews become the enemy. I mean, they're going to swallow and consume everyone apart from those who they think are totally supporting their messianic neo-Zionist vision of a fascist Israel that is feared by its neighbors and has expunged the whole Palestinian issue out of history and out of geography. And this is not going to work. This is not going to work because there is a limit to how far you can go, especially with the origins of this project, that at least its founders believe that material help is not enough, that you need moral legitimacy for its existence. Now, this moral legitimacy has been seriously eroded. These particular politicians and leaders do not think moral legitimacy, international moral legitimacy, is important anymore. That is true, and that's why they have no inhibitions in what they're going to do. I'm not sure that this is the zeitgeist that we live in, that really you can totally ignore that kind of thing. After all, there are other rogue states in the world, and we tend to forget that some of these rogue states do suffer from sanctions, do suffer from isolation, We are not sure that this is going to be something sustainable just because there is this belief that you don't care about the moral illegitimacy, or because there are, as we talked before, this kind of political movements and leaders in the world who don't care about moral validity as well. I do agree that they exist, and they are probably preventing us from finishing this project sooner rather than later. But in the end of the world, I do believe and I feel connected to so many movements of change in the world, especially among the younger generation, that I refuse to accept that the current situation is fatalistic, that, you know, there's nothing we can do. If we believe that we can do something, then we can do something about Palestine as well. This is closely connected. I mean, if you want a better Britain, in terms of your universal values, your economic, social, cultural values, if you believe that it could be a more just Britain and so on, if you think the Labour Party is not really representing these values as much as one hoped for, then you should be also hopeful about Palestine. The things are interconnected. They're very interconnected. So sometimes it's more complex, but on the other hand, it shows you that even if you Palestinians understandably would feel totally alone and isolated, they're much less alone and isolated than maybe they can realize in this terrible conditions in which they experience right now.
There's one thing we will end on hope, by the way, I promise.
Okay, great. So many of these conversations end with despair.
I know, exactly, that has happened a lot. But yeah. I interviewed Gideon Levy the other week, and I managed him to say some hopeful things. So maybe there is hope after all.
That's unique, because he's exactly the pessimist.
Yeah. Obviously, a huge fan of his, but it was heartening to hear him talking hopeful terms. Before I do that, I mean, in terms of, I guess, genocidal fervor, I'm not quite sure, genocidal mania, I've often described it. I'm interested in this in a historical context and how many precedents there are for it. There were very many. I interviewed so many courageous Jewish Israeli figures on this channel, and we'll keep doing so. That you're courageous because you're at present isolated, and the polling is bleak, if I'm honest. I mean, you know, some polls show about half, you know, there's a 50-50 split amongst Jewish Israelis between those who think enough firepower has been used in Gaza and the other half thinking not enough has been used. About 60% consistently opposing all humanitarian aid being allowed into Gaza, which would mean everybody dying in brutal terms. What I'm interested in is, I guess, the ingredients here, because I often think about Serb nationalism in Bosnia as one parallel, because Serbs were victims in the war. They were the victims of genocide. The Ustashi, the Croatian collaborators, I mean, the Nazis thought they were very too extreme in some ways. And they also suffered atrocities in the Bosnian War. And they fused that sense of victimhood, which had a basis, it wasn't fictional, with a sense of superiority as well, that they were superior to the Bosniaks, for example. Now, I mean, in this situation, you have that, you know, because Jewish people have been for 2,000 years persecuted, culminating within living memory, of course, of the Shoah, the extermination of 6 million Jews, 2/3 of Europe's population, in a very short space of time. So that victimhood is real. And then you have the settler colonialism and the mentality settler colonialism generates in all different, in many different contexts. You have impunity, I suppose, which is an extra, maybe a different. The Bosnian Serbs didn't have impunity, did they? Mm-hmm. Actually, they, you know, I mean, no. there was military intervention. Is that, what do you think? I mean, I'm just interested in how are those the kind of unique ingredients which have conspired to create the grounds for what are, you know, because only 2% of any society are sociopaths. It's not like most people have this power of empathy, which is eliminated by dehumanization. And that dehumanization of the Palestinians is extremely widespread. I'm wondering, how unprecedented is that, what we're looking at in Israel? And is it actually, do you think it's impunity added in to those different other ingredients which you have seen in other societies?
I think that the phenomenon itself of dehumanization in Israel is not unique.
No.
I mean, it's an extreme example, because it is kind of a double dose of dehumanization. It's a fusion of romantic nationalism, which is always a variant of nationalism that totally dehumanizes anyone who does not belong to the nation, ever since this kind of brand of nationalism emerged in Europe in the mid-19th century, together with settler colonialism, which of course dehumanizes from the very beginning of its encounter with any indigenous native population, the native population as part of its wish to displace and replace the local people. So you have kind of a double dose here, if you want, of dehumanization. I think what is unique is not so much the dehumanization itself, and which is reflected, as you rightly said, in the polls of support for the war, or even the wish to stop the war, not because it is a dehumanized war, but because they believe it might lead to the release of the hostages, or they don't want to see many more soldiers killed or whatever. But the main motive is not the suffering of the Palestinians here. I think what is unique, and I cannot find an example, and actually it comes out in your attempt to compare it to Bosnia, is the international exceptionalism, that dehumanization. You know, you hear philosophers of morality, especially in places like France, the United States, and Germany, people who I've known for years, and I really respected their writing, their contribution to articulating what is humanity, what is morality, and so on, and they forget their own value system, their own preachings when they talk about Israel. It's quite remarkable. It's like they become total idiots when they talk about Israel and Palestine, as if anything they themselves have written about, preached about, is not relevant to the case of Israel, as if they are fear that they fear to say the word Jewish racism, for instance, in this connection. And I think that kind of immunity for the dehumanization is unique. It's very unique. And of course, it contributes to the dehumanization itself, because if you are not condemned for your dehumanizing the Palestinians, there's very little incentive to stop it. And I think that was the great shock for the Israelis, mm-hmm. what happened in the ICJ and the ICC. And still, if you read the Israeli analysis of the ICJ and the ICC, they say this is nothing new. This is part of this new anti-Semitism, which luckily we have powerful friends from the United States to Britain and other places that would make sure that this is an insignificant development. And of course, when the United States threatens the ICC in particular, after it issued the arrest warrant for Netanyahu, they feel, you know, that this is validated in their approach. So the dehumanization itself was there, maybe hidden because of this international exceptionalism. But those of us who were born here, like myself, who were part of the educational system here, were always aware of it, that this is the way, you know, every generation of Israeli graduates from the mainstream school system can only have this kind of perspective on Palestinians, totally dehumanization. And when it goes, when these young people go through the army, it increases even, because you have the power to translate dehumanization into actual killing and elimination, actual elimination. And that's what we have seen, not only in Gaza. We keep forgetting how many young people and children and women were killed by the Israelis in the West Bank, yeah. how many of them were killed during yeah. the Nakba and so on. So it has been there for 76 years. It just became more extreme. And yet again, the most important part of it is the Western attitude towards it, rather than the essence of it.
Let's talk about hope. And you talked before, actually, about what we could almost describe as a great divergence going on in the global Jewish community, because there are as many Jewish people in the United States or around as there are in Israel. I mean, they've got almost the same Jewish population. Obviously, it's not concentrated in the way it's in the Israelis, but you see what I mean. And you alluded to this in the polling. The polling 6 months ago found 30% of Jewish Americans think Israel is genocide. And it found 40% of Jewish Americans under the age of 45 thought that Israel was committing genocide. And the even, you know, polling with the even younger Jewish Americans also finds even more damning results. We've seen Jewish Americans at the forefront of solidarity movements with Palestine. I mean, do you think that's, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because what's happened, I mean, traditionally Jewish Americans have always been a very relatively progressive demographic. I'm not saying the Democrats are obviously a left-wing party, but they've consistently rejected the Republicans in every election. After World War II, there was the leftist candidate. They were the most likely then again to support that particular candidate. So there's always been this Jewish progressive tradition in the United States, which has always existed. But do you think this is significant in that, you know, because obviously amongst younger Jewish Americans, they're having a different perspective, because often older Jewish Americans kind of had this progressive view of Israel, don't they? They still hark back to that idea. Do you think that's a potential existential threat? Because I think Gideon Levy, for example, when I speak to him, the hope he often thinks is that something's got to give. American public opinion shifting, but notably Jewish American public opinion is shifting, and that's what matters.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I look at this whole process of what I call the beginning or the end as a process that has as discrete processes, that some of them have not much in common, but one day I think will fuse into a very powerful transformative event. And I talk about these processes like cracks, extensive cracks in the foundation of a building. And one of these extensive cracks is what you have just described about the Jewish community. It's not the only one. I don't think you can bring down a set of colonial projects, but just one of these processes. These processes have to meet together in one historical, as happened in South Africa, in one historical moment, that some of the circumstances of that moment have nothing to do with your activism. Sometimes things happen that seem unrelated and happen. So that's just in general. But yeah, more focused. Indeed, it is very important. And I would say something to these polls and statistics. I think sometimes they hide an important fact, not by intention, but because the nature of this profession. When you have these high numbers, you have to understand that this is not just 40% and 30%. Most people who are American Jews do not deal with political issues in the public domain. It means that if you had an ability to find out what is the percentage among Jews who are willing not just to take care of their own life, who really think that there is some bigger causes than their own life, for which they're willing to be a part of, are willing even to sacrifice a career, a connection with the family and the community, want to be active in it, I think the percentage is far higher. I mean, if you take it, whoever is willing to be an activist under the age of 45 among the American Jews, definitely 30 years ago, the vast majority would do it on behalf of Israel. Today, the vast majority of them would do it on behalf of Palestine. And that's a fundamental change. And some of these people might be the senators and the representatives or the mainstream journalists of the future. We don't know. We don't know what happens to them when they come, when they enjoy the corridors of power. But there is a big potential here. But as I said, by itself, this is not enough. I think the isolation in the community, the internal implosion of Israel from within economically and socially, I'm still not convinced about the invincibility of the Israeli army, as everybody is now. And I'm not sure that we have seen the end of the revolutionary forces in the Arab world. And all of that, together with a possibility of a new generation of Palestinians who would lead the Palestinian liberation movement in a more unified, a more representative, a more democratic way, which is a very, there's a good possibility for that happening as well, if you look at the younger generation. All this together, I think, means that at this dark moment, Palestinians may find it difficult to believe, but I think they are, as I said in the beginning of our conversation, they are at the end of the worst chapter in their history that began in 1948, and I think we are reaching the beginning of a better chapter, but we are not there yet. Undoubtedly, we're not there yet. And we are all not onlookers on that. We can each individually and collectively contribute to that new chapter beginning sooner rather than later.
My final question actually is linked to that, and it could be hopeful or despairing, I suppose, depending on how you look at it. Is that for me, it was actually said by the US service personnel who self-immolated early this year, Aaron Bushell. And he said, many of us like to ask ourselves, what would I do if I was alive during slavery or the Jim Crow South or apartheid? What would I do if my country was committing genocide? The answer is, you're doing it right now. And for me, part of me thinks, well, look, this crime is so obscene, so depraved, just, so confessed to, so evidenced that, I've never lived through something talking about the complicity of the West, because obviously lots of other crimes have happened in my life, but they've been accepted as crimes. Rwanda is accepted as, it's not the same. But to go through where Western fingerprints are all over it, it's so obvious to me that surely this has to go down in history as just one of the great crimes of our age. And I'm, but then I think, well, that's either we're going to have that, and if we don't, it's because we're, the future of the West is fascist barbarism, and in which case we've got bigger things as well, I'm afraid, to worry about. And I'm just wondering what you think about that, because part of me thinks, this could just be a foreshadow, actually. I mean, some people worry about that, and that's why the far right look at Israel actually as something to aspire to. They see it as the front line of Western civilization against the the Muslim hordes and barbarians. You see the exporting of technology, by the way, elsewhere, and the rise of very right-wing authoritarian movements. I just wondering what you think about that in terms of where we're heading, because, you know, it seems so obvious that this, I mean, from a historical perspective, you kind of think, well, obviously history has to record it for what it is. But what's your sense of what, you know, that's an open-ended question. Interpret as you wish.
Yeah, I think there are two aspects I can kind of respond to. One, when think about Bushmell and people like himself, I think what was very characteristic of him was that he did not get his information on what was going on in Palestine from the main American media, that he needed the alternative media as a source of information that helped him to form the very desperate but courageous moral position, which is an important aspect to think about it, the role of the alternative media and the lack of confidence. And you've just written a brilliant article on this on the BBC. There is a great crisis of confidence in the mainstream media in the West, which I think we're still not appreciating how it will play out in the future. But it will play out in the future when people would say, we don't trust them on Palestine, then we don't trust them also on other issues. And that is something very important that, of course, can play a very positive role in it. As for the right-wing part of what I call the Global Israel Alliance, or the alliance of maintaining the political systems as they are today, I don't know, from an historical perspective, the right was always strong when the left was unable to unite. The right by itself, I don't think, is that strong, as people put it. It is always strong when the left is not talking in a clear voice, forgets its own universal values, and it tends to be purist and forget about pragmatism in order to create powerful alliances. Look, Kamala Harris was an example of the first one. Not very clear what is the alternative and so on. She had no chance against a populist leader. I think Bernie Sanders would have done much better than Kamala Harris in America. Secondly, look at the second round of the French elections. What happened when the left have put aside, unfortunately for not too long, but have put aside its dissent and defeated the extreme right in France? I think this is the lesson for us all. That when we are dealing with existential issues, and the issue in Palestine is existential, and as I say, I don't think it's just existential for the Palestinians. It's the existential for many other people. We need to be able to create the alliances. That, by the way, I saw in the demonstration in London when I joined another 1 million people. You have the Muslim community, you had the left, you had the liberals, all united under this one issue. And of course, they have their own disagreements on some issues, which I don't underrate and don't regard as unimportant. But they knew the demonstration was a manifestation of what is important and what is less important right now. And I think that kind of alliances that work so well in the solidarity movement in the streets should now be part of the action in politics from above as well, in order to be able to deal with this, because with these kinds of alliance, you will find out, and that's my assessment, that populism, fascism, and extreme right-wing politics are not as attractive as we believe it is, because they just enter a void that someone else can still fill. So I think there's a lot of thinking to be done about how do we deal with the essence of politics, and what is the new role of the left in turning the struggle against the essence of politics into a more effective struggle that would have also, of course, implication for the situation in Palestine?
I have to say, surprisingly heartening. I wasn't expecting that. But also full of nuance, full of wisdom. Obviously, your encyclopedic knowledge of this whole area shines through as ever. And it's been such an honour. I know you know, I can anticipate the response this will get. People will be so appreciative of what you have to say and provocative in the best possible way as well. So for those who are watching, please do share this video. Press like, press subscribe, leave your comments. Good for the algorithm. More people watch and engage and listen, which is the point, of course. And Bitterland, honestly, such an honor. And thanks as ever for your incredible insight.
Thank you, Owen. I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you very much for having me.